Okay, so let us carry on where we left off. And again, we're looking at this Atta Danda Sutta, the taking up of punishment or taking up of violence, or however you want to translate this. And initially, we just looked at the idea of right view, how to look at the world, how to think about the world, and this understanding that the sensory realm is always a realm of conflict, a realm of violence, a realm of wars, a realm of all of these problems, because it is inherent to that realm. You cannot have that realm without violence. And very simply, it's because we share the sensory world. And whenever we share something, there's going to be competition over things. There's going to be rivalry. We want the same things in that world. We want the same partners. We want the same salary raise. We want the same things in that world because it is external to us and we share it. That's why there's always going to be conflict in that world. And there's a beautiful simile. I said I wasn't going to mention it last time, but it's a beautiful simile found in the Potalia Sutta, Majjhima 54. So whenever I say a sutta, someone is going to note it down. I'm going to print it out. So maybe I shouldn't. I can just say the whole Tipitaka straight away. Print out the whole thing, and then it's done with. No, I'm not going to do that. That's very naughty. Yeah. So in Majjhima 54, you have the Potalia Sutta, and it has all the similes of sensual pleasures. Why they are so problematic? Why the sensory realm is so difficult? And one of the similes is the simile of the bird and the piece of meat. Yeah, there's like a bird gets hold of a piece of meat. Birds are very happy when they get a piece of meat because usually birds have to make do with insects and other creepy crawlies. A piece of meat is kind of, high-end stuff for the birds. So it gets hold of a piece of meat. And of course, if a bird gets hold of a piece of meat, other birds want the same piece of meat. Yeah, we're competing over the things in the world. And this is kind of the point. And if it is a small bird gets pursued by bigger birds, that bird is in trouble. And very often might even die or have, certainly a lot of suffering because of that. And this is the nature of that world, the competition that we have. So the only way is to let go of that piece of meat and find your happiness in a more profound place and find it within instead. Because within there is no competition. Within there is no, we're not sharing the inner world that is private to each one of us. And that's why there is no competition. Not only is there no competition, but if you develop that inner world, because it develops qualities that have to do with harmony, with kindness, etc., it actually has a positive effect also on the outer world. And we become less competitive, and we become more harmonious in the outer world. So the inner world, developing the inner world, also has a positive effect on the outer world. And this is kind of the beauty of this. There's a double benefit always, beneficial for ourselves, but also beneficial for everyone around us. So the Buddha, to be realized this problem in the world, and when you realize the purpose here, of course, by understanding the problems in the world, is not to make you depressed and sad and these kind of things. This is what happens with a lot of people. Yeah, you look at the world and you see all the problems, the climate change, the COVID, the wars, the refugees and all that thing, and people often get depressed. And that is a very unfortunate consequence of seeing all the problems in the world. But of course, the right response to seeing the problems in the world is not to get depressed. That doesn't really help. Yeah, I can sort of understand why people get depressed, but it's not really helpful. So instead, the Buddhist answer is to turn away from that world because you know it is inherently problematic. And then you move towards the spiritual practice instead, precisely that place where you have a refuge from that world, and it makes you independent of that world. This is the whole point of the spiritual practice. And it's such an important point, because once you do that, you let go of the whole five sense world. There's a massive thing that you're letting go of. This swamp, current, yeah, that whole massive problem of that world, in all kind of one fell swoop, as I said, the whole thing is just kind of let go of. And that's kind of the purpose of this kind of reflection. So please don't allow these things to kind of make you sad or depressed. That's not kind of the point. The point is to guide you in the right direction towards what is really worthwhile. This is the idea here of right view. So now we are looking at the practice. We have been looking at a few factors already of the practice to get out of this problem. And I'm going to continue. It's a bit kind of random. Yeah, this is a verse. It's not very systematic. It's just some random factors of the path, kind of in a spoken about in a sort of inspiring way. That's kind of the idea here. Some of the inspiration is lost because the Pali verse is metrical and often very beautiful. It often has a very kind of beautiful style to it. But that meter and that rhythm to the verse is lost when you translate it into English. So it doesn't have the same power in English as it has in Pali, unfortunately. But never mind. We're going to look at it anyway. So we were just saying that a person intent on quenching does not stand for arrogance. That was the last thing we had a look at this morning. And again, if you are intent on quenching, the word here is nibbana, the quenching. You don't stand for arrogance. Well, I said before that arrogance is a kind of delusion. But arrogance is also the opposite of quenching, because one of the things that we are trying to quench is the sense of self. And arrogance is like the opposite of quenching. It is like building up the sense of self, yeah, the sense of superiority and all that kind of thing. So that's why you don't really want to get into arrogance or conceit or pride, because these are anti-nibbana. The anti-nibbana, something like that anyway. So let's carry on with these verses. Don't be led into lying or get caught up in fondness for form. Completely understand conceit and desist from hasty conduct. Don't be led into lying. Don't allow the mind to kind of go there. It's very easy to fall into the trap of lying in the world. But as a practitioner of the path, we avoid this to the best of our ability. There's lots of things to be said about these precepts about lying, etc. Of course, lying itself there's a great variety of lying. There is lying that is really bad, like when you are angry or you are greedy and you lie because of your anger or your greed. That's when it's really bad. But sometimes lying can also be more benign. If you lie because you want to protect somebody or something, you're coming from compassion. It's a very different thing. Ideally, you don't lie then either. But maybe you can find a way of talking. But in that case, it's not really such a terrible thing anymore. It is the motivation that decides the ethical value of an action. It is not the action itself. Very often people say, I did this, I did that. Is it good or bad? And I say, I don't know. What is your motivation? That motivation is what matters. You can't really say sometimes whether something is good or bad without knowing the motivation. And this is one of those beautiful things about Buddhist ethics. The action itself is not what determines the ethical value of that act. It is the motivation behind it actually decides these things. And it opens up a beautiful way of thinking about the world that allows for great flexibility in the whole sphere of ethics. But anyway, as a general principle, don't lie. Don't get caught up in fondness for form. Form are the things that we see in the world. In particular, when we see other people, we may get attracted to other people. This is probably the greatest attraction when it comes to form. And you get attracted to someone, that is when you get caught up in fondness for form. Of course, one of the great things we have just been seeing already, the right view, is to remember old age. That form doesn't last. That form is subject to decline, sometimes very quickly. Doesn't take many years from you are young and youthful till you are kind of deteriorating. That's just the way these things are. So you see that old age lurking under the surface, and you know that there is no lasting benefit or no lasting delight in that form, because it will deteriorate. Sometimes you can train these perceptions and you look at people and you actually see that old age right there inside that person as you see them. It's kind of fascinating. And you no longer, it means you no longer rejoice in that youthfulness, in that fondness for form, if you like. Completely understand conceit. Completely understand conceit. So in other words, don't, again, this conceit in Pali is a very profound thing. It has to do with the very idea of I am, the idea of identity. So you penetrate the whole idea of identity. There's a mix here of very profound things and more kind of ordinary things. Again, because it is verse, it's supposed to be inspirational there. Let me just have a quick look here. Yeah, manansha, which is, yeah, so that's basically what it means. And desist from hasty conduct. Don't conduct yourself too fast. Don't do things without reflection. Always be very careful. There's a beautiful sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya where the Buddha teaches his son, Rahula. And he says that when you act, when you speak, or when you think, you should always reflect beforehand. Is this going to be the right thing? And the Buddha says, it's just like having a mirror. And so the translation reflection is very right, because just like you're reflecting your face or whatever in the mirror, in the same way, you reflect on this action beforehand. Is this going to be useful? So in Buddhism, we try to be a bit more deliberate. Not too deliberate. I mean, there comes a point when you get really uptight and tense because you try to kind of figure out everything beforehand. So you try to find a kind of a way you can be relaxed, but you try to reflect on things beforehand. We try not to be too spontaneous. And this is where kind of the difficulties of the path comes in. Yeah, sometimes it's nice to be spontaneous. People enjoy spontaneity because it's like you are releasing something inside of yourself. You're allowing yourself just to be what you are. This is the delight of spontaneity. Not having to reflect, just going with the flow, so to speak. The problem is that flow is sometimes defiled. And when the flow is defiled, you end up doing stupid things as a consequence. So sometimes we need that little bit of tension, yeah, just to say stop, wait, is this wise or not? Hold back a little bit, don't act straight away here. And then when you know that your mind is pure, okay, then you go along with the action. And after a while, it becomes like second nature. You know that you are pure in the moment, you don't have any strong defilements. And when you know that, you can start acting spontaneously again, or almost spontaneously, because you are aware of the purity of your mind at that particular time. But be careful there. Yeah, don't go too fast. Don't do things too fast. Don't relish the old or welcome the new. Yeah, this is very similar to what we find in the Baddhekaratta Sutta. Baddhekaratta Sutta is a sutta you find in the Majjhima Nikaya, One Fortunate Night. And this sutta has this kind of very basic verse that it is said that everyone should remember. I'll read it out for you because I got it right here. And it goes as follows. Don't run back to the past. Don't hope for the future. What's past is left behind. The future has not arrived. And phenomena in the present are clearly seen in every case. Knowing this, foster it. Unfaltering, unshakable. Today is the day to keenly work. Who knows? Tomorrow may bring death. For there is no bargain to be struck with death and his mighty hordes. The peaceful sage explained it is those who keenly meditate like this, tireless all night and day, who truly have that one fine night. Yeah, that's kind of one of those basic verses on the Dhamma, the idea of not going into the past, not hoping for the future. Yeah, instead, staying with the present is the idea. And this is exactly what we see here. I think this is just an alternative way of expressing the same thing. Yeah. Don't relish the old. Yeah, don't kind of think, oh, the good old days, everything was so much better. The good old days are just another delusion. There aren't any good old days, right? It's kind of just, I'm always fascinated, sometimes we look to the past, we bring out the old pictures, yeah, when we were young and when kind of we had this beautiful summer holidays and the sun was always shining or whatever. And one of the things that you will notice when you look at the old pictures of yourself, yeah, everyone is always smiling, yeah. Yeah, and whenever we say to, you know, if I take a picture, everyone say, smile, yeah, 1, 2, 3, cheese, and everyone is supposed to smile, or something silly like that. And of course, when we always smile in our pictures, we are breeding delusion. We are pretending that the past was wonderful and great. Instead of smiling on the picture, we should all look grumpy in our pictures, yeah? The past was really bad, the past was terrible. That's what we should be doing. That's much more honest. The past isn't any better than the present, right? The good old days are just another illusion. Old days were good, some of them were bad, some of them were neutral. And we try to somehow pretend that they were different. In fact, for anyone who is practicing the spiritual path, the future, the present is always better because we're actually going somewhere. Our minds are getting purified. We're building up some sort of happiness within. Right now is the time when things are the best because we have built up the maximum of good qualities up to this point. The future, we don't know what's going to happen. The past, well, the past, we were less Buddhist, less well practitioned, so the past is not interesting. Right now is when we are actually kind of reached the peak of spiritual qualities. Not only that, but it's also now that we are creating the future. And this is one of those beautiful things you can do in your meditation, to remind yourself that you don't create the future by thinking about it. Why do we worry about the future? Why do we reflect on the future in our meditation or whenever it is? Well, the reason is because we're trying to control the future. That's why we're thinking about it. Yeah, should I do this? Should I do that? We're trying to imagine the future. And by imagining it, again, we're trying to control it. We're trying to resolve the issues and the problems. Right? But that is not how you control the future. If you want to control the future, if you want to create a good future, the way to do that is to make good karma in the present. If you live well now, then your future is going to be bright, regardless of what happens in the world. And this is the beauty of these teachings, is that when you look at the world, and we have just seen, according to the sutta, how the world is always going to be problematic. Well, if the world is problematic, there's only one way to make a good future, and that is to live well here and now. And if you live well here and now, then regardless of what happens in the world, you will have created a good future for yourself. You will have built up the good qualities inside. This is how you create that good future. Not by resolving all the problems, not by imagining the future, trying to solve all the issues here and now. So creating the future happens now, sitting down, being peaceful, having a sense of metta, having a sense of compassion for the world, purifying your mind of unwholesome states. That is how you make a good future. And once you get that, why on earth would you think about the future anymore? It doesn't make any sense. The whole rationale for thinking about the future collapses because the future is made in an entirely different way from what you think. This is kind of the idea. So let go of that future. Let go of the past. And then come to the present. This is where the real action is. Here and now, not anywhere else. So don't relish all or welcome the new. Don't grieve for what is running out. Yeah, what is diminishing? Your lifespan is diminishing. Your whatever it is that is diminishing in the world. Your wealth is diminishing. I don't know. Whatever it is, things are running out. Don't grieve for that. Why not? Because you're already building up the good qualities already. You're already heading in a good direction. The future of a good person is always bright. Don't grieve for what is running out or get attached to things that pull you in. Yeah, so in the present, also stay kind of unattached. Just go with the flow, observe things, but don't allow them to pull you in. This is what sense restraint is about. The idea of having an even mind in the middle of the world, not allowing the world to either attract you or repel you from desires or the opposite of desires, the rejection of things. Greed, I say, is the great flood, and longing is the current, the base is the compulsion, the swamp of sensuality, so hard to get past. Yeah, this idea again of greed or desire being like a flood, and of course it is a mental flood, it's the kind of the mind flowing on because of craving, always moving on somewhere else. And part of that flood is the longing for something, yeah, is the current. We're longing for things in the world. And of course, both greed and longing, they are a problem. Because the greed is always for things that are not really important anyway. We're greedy for things that don't really matter. Things that we can never get. Things that are not really interesting, even if you get them. And it's the same thing for longing. We are longing for things that are pointless in the world usually. And so let go of the longing and come back to the spiritual path. Then you are on the right track. The basis, the compulsion, the swamp of sensuality, so hard to get past. The compulsion here, I guess the idea is... good question, what is the idea? It's one of those fairly obscure words in the Pali language. Pakappanang. Anyway, it doesn't matter. I think the idea here that Bhantasiddhartha's translation is that it is very compelling, the sensual world. We tend to get drawn into it. But that is why it is the swamp of sensuality, which is so hard to get past. You get stuck, you sink into the swamp, and then it's very hard to get out. You have to kind of pull yourself out. But actually, the momentum is so high, and because the momentum is so high, you are really deeply stuck in that world. And gradually, you emerge from that world of sensuality. So this is the path. This is kind of how, this is some ideas about the practice of the path. And the last part of this long poem is then about the sage. It is about the person, the arahant, who has come out of this, who has actually done the practice and reached the other shore on the other side. And what is interesting about looking at the sage, maybe you think we are going way ahead of ourselves because we are still looking at right view, which is the beginning of the path, and of course the sage lies at the very end of the path. But of course the point of view of the sage is also a point of view, is also right view. Right view, yes, you start with right view, but when you come to the very end of the path, that right view becomes purified. It becomes it achieves its highest possible purity. That's kind of the end of the path. So by understanding the sage, which here is the arahant, we also understand a right view in a kind of more purified form. So you can see how everything is interlinked in this way. So I thought it might be nice to look at it now as well, to maybe draw out some of the... what it means to be a sage, what it means to be an arahant, and how it relates to the idea of right view. So let's just do that fairly quickly. I don't want to spend too much time on this because there just isn't time for everything, but let's see what happens. So the sage never strays from the truth. The Brahman stands firm on the shore. Having given up everything, they are said to be at peace. The sage never strays from the truth, and of course the reason for that is because once you are a sage, you have internalized the Buddhist path, and because you have internalized it, you cannot stray from the truth. You cannot have crazy wisdom. The wisdom you have is the sane wisdom. If someone has crazy wisdom, I always say you're either crazy or you are wise. You're not both at the same time. So crazy wisdom is a oxymoron. And it's a bad idea. It's kind of, this is how you dupe people in the world. I just got crazy wisdom. But you're doing all these crazy things. It's crazy wisdom. Don't buy that kind of those kind of things, because it's the way to get duped and the way to get taken down the garden path, and you're in serious problem as a consequence. So you never stray from the truth. You have internalized morality. The sage is always moral. The sage always does the right thing. This is how we can know whether someone is a sage or not. One of the ways, by looking at their conduct. The Brahmin stands firm on the shore. For most people, the world is always shaking. The world is always uncertain. There's always like impermanence there. But for the Brahmin, the arahant, you can stand firm. There's no longer any shaking. You are solid. You are no longer subject to the impermanence of the world. You're still subject to it, but not mentally. Mentally, you are solid. You no longer get affected by the impermanence of the world. And having given up everything, you are said to be at peace. It's kind of interesting, isn't it? Instead of accumulating things, instead of holding on to the things that we have in the world, it is by giving things up that you find peace in the world. Isn't that extraordinary? It's kind of the exact opposite of what people usually think. And this is what is so, again, so extraordinary about the Dhamma. It is full of these paradoxes, full of these ways of thinking about life that is so utterly foreign to most people. And this is why the Buddha says elsewhere, there's a beautiful verse somewhere where the Buddha says that what ordinary people think is happiness, the noble ones know is suffering. And what ordinary people think is suffering, the noble one think is happiness. It is almost as if they see the world upside down. It is by the giving up that you become happy. It is by giving up that you find peace. It is by giving up that you find the meaning of life, not by accumulating. And if you give up everything, then of course, then there is no, you can no longer, giving up here doesn't mean like physically giving it away. Giving up means not attaching to things. And it means that it doesn't really matter anymore. It means that if you lose those things because you have no attachment, you just shrug your shoulders and it's not no big deal. Part of that giving up is the giving up of your own five aggregates, the five khandhas, the body, the mind. You don't have an attachment to your own mind. It may sound paradoxical. How can you not have an attachment to your own mind? But that is what the arahant is like. And so if someone says, I'm going to kill you, you say, yeah, whatever, it's up to you, it's the opposite of how people in the world think about things. If someone comes and tells you they're going to kill you, what do you say? You probably say, thanks but no thanks, or something like that. This is not the right time, I'm not an arahant yet, please wait a few years and then come back, ask again later on, something like that. Usually we are not so keen on those things, And so this is the idea of being at peace, not having any ownership, not holding on to anything. The idea of giving things up mentally. That is where you find the real peace. Why? Because the impermanence of the world can no longer touch you when everything is given up. That is why. The impermanence always shakes us up when you hold on to things. Because you are no longer able to hold on when impermanence comes around. You have to. It gets ripped from your grip, even though you try to cling on to things. And that is painful. The moment you don't hold on anymore, impermanence doesn't have the ability to shake you up anymore. So that's why, giving up everything, you find the highest peace. They have truly known, they are a knowledge master. A knowledge master is Vedagu. And this is a word that they used in ancient India. The Brahmins used for someone who knew the Vedas. The Vedas are the scriptures of the Brahmins. And the Buddha then redefines it as someone who has achieved awakening. That's the Vedagu. Understanding the teachings, they are independent. The idea that you not actually depend on anything in the world. You don't depend even on anything within yourself. You are free from all of those things. They proceed rightly in the world, not coveting anything here. You don't covet anything because you've given everything up. You understand the problem with things. And you just proceed in the world without really touching the world, without really having any interest in the world. But you proceed, you carry on because of compassion, because you want to teach maybe, or you want to help out a little bit before eventually you pass away. One who has crossed over sensuality here, the snare in the world, so hard to get past. This is another... simile for sensuality, the snare in the world. It catches you out, grabs hold of your mind, and then you cannot really, you are held by sensuality. And because you have given up that, you don't grieve. Yeah, because you don't grieve because you cannot lose anything anymore. It is only when we are attached that we grieve, because it's only when we are attached that we can lose things. If there's nothing to be lost, grief becomes impossible. Nor do you hope, because you're not really aiming to achieve anything in the world. You have no hopes, you have no griefs. And you live in the present instead, forgetting, giving up the past and the future. They have cut the strings, they are no longer bound. We are the puppets on the string. We are, Mara is playing with us. Like puppets, string puppets. And Mara pulls the string and you run after the things of the world. The strings are like craving. The strings are the beautiful things in the world. Gives rise to craving. And you run around, the slave of craving, the slave to Mara. Mara is in charge. You are the slave. And it's kind of interesting because normally we think that craving is our friend. Because when I crave, then I can run after all the wonderful things in life. My friend craving. Not only do you think craving is your friend, but you even identify with craving. Because craving gives rise to this feeling that there's a purpose in life. We identify with the doer inside. Because we identify with the doer, we feel alive when we do. You know what I mean? I'm sure everyone here knows exactly what I mean. When you do things, you create things, you feel alive. Why? Because you are indulging the sense of doing, which you identify with. And because you are indulging the sense of doing that you identify with, you think craving is your friend. And craving, in fact, you identify with craving itself, because craving is very similar to the idea of doing. So these things kind of merge, become one thing. And you are craving. You relish craving. Not really understanding that you are just being driven around like a slave. And that is what you start to see in your meditation practice. Craving dies down and you feel the sense of slavery. The string puppet, the strings are being cut and you're no longer being played by Mara, played by craving. But you are liberated from those things. This is hard to see, right? But you start to get a feeling for why this must be true once you start to read these things. You start to understand the Buddha has really seen something very powerful here. And you may not fully grasp what is going on, but I'm sure everyone here has some idea that there's something here which is very profound and very beautiful. And so you start to unravel this and you start to kind of gradually move in the right direction. What came before, let it wither away, and after, let there be nothing. Just let the past go, let it wither. Who cares about the past? It's finished. It's not really interesting. What is interesting is what we do now, because now we are creating the future. And after, let there be nothing. This, of course, is a very profound thing. Let there be nothing basically means that there is no interest in the future. And because there is no interest in the future, if there's nothing in the future, that is kind of the ideal future for someone who is really practicing in the highest way. Nothing is one of the highest things in Buddhism. Very kind of hard to grasp. When everything comes to an end, that is the highest kind of beauty, the highest kind of happiness. If you don't grasp at the middle, you will live at peace. Neither the past nor the future, and you don't grasp in the middle, you don't grasp what is here now, then you are peaceful. One who has no sense of ownership in the whole realm of name and form, nama rupa, does not grieve for that which is not. They suffer no loss in the world. The one who has no sense of ownership, when you own absolutely nothing, including your own body and mind, the whole realm of name and form. Name and form here is really just another way of talking about the personality. It's a personality idea. You can say that name and form are all the mental factors and all the physical factors of a person. But name and form is also what makes you into an individual. Yeah, you have a name. That's how you identify yourself. You have a form. When you see yourself in the mirror, you recognize yourself. You are identified by your form and by your name. That is how you know who you are. So it is kind of in this whole realm of individuality is one way of thinking about name and form. In this whole realm of individuality, there is no ownership anymore. Yeah. So you don't hold on to anything that has to do with you anymore. You don't really exist anymore in the ordinary sense. Individuality has come to cease to exist. And this is kind of the part of what this is about. No more me. No more of this painful ego always trying to assert itself, trying to be somebody. Or sometimes not succeeding and then being nobody and you grieve because you feel like you are inferior or whatever. Superiority, inferiority, equality, all of these things are a problem. So because of that, because you have no sense of even individuality anymore, or having no ownership in the whole world, you don't grieve for that which is not. Yeah, it doesn't matter to you anymore. You've given it all up. You cannot suffer any loss in the world when you have no ownership in the first place. If you don't think of anything as belonging to yourself or others, not finding anything to be mine, you won't grieve thinking, I don't have it. The same point again. Yeah, if you have no ownership, you'd never feel, I don't have it. So you are always cool, cool at heart. Not bitter, not fawning, not greedy, really, I think is an easy translation. Not bitter, not greedy, unstirred, everywhere even. When asked about one who is unshakable, I declare that that is the benefit. Again, you are have an even mind, you are unshakable, and that unshakability is the benefit from a Buddhist point of view. You're no longer buffeted around by all the things of the world. For the unstirred who understands, there is no performance of deeds. Desisting from instigation, they see sanctuary everywhere. And when you are unstirred, when you are unshakable, you don't perform deeds of karma. Right? This is kind of what it means. You don't actually create any future anymore through your karma because you're not interested in the future. You're no longer projecting into the future. You never really think that you are going to create the future through your actions. This is what intention is about. Intention is always about looking to the future. It's about your goals, your aims, the purpose in life. But once you are fully awakened in this way, you're not really looking to the future anymore. You don't have any intentions for the future because you know that happiness is found right here and now. Close your eyes, watch your breath, go into a state of samadhi, give up all intentions and the will. That is where happiness is to be found, not in some future state. And so you give up all this karmic activity. You don't create karma anymore because you don't have that chaitana, that will, that intention that tries to create a future in a certain way. So the arahant doesn't create karma anymore, according to this. Desisting from instigation, right? You don't instigate anything. You're not trying to achieve anything. And because of that, sanctuary is everywhere. Wherever you are in the world, you have a sanctuary. Because you cannot really be disappointed anymore. It's impossible because you're not holding on to anything. That's kind of nice, isn't it? You don't have to come to Jhana Grove to find sanctuary. This is kind of a nice sanctuary, but you know, you don't have to come here. You don't have to become a monk to find sanctuary or a nun. You can kind of sanctuaries everywhere once you're an arahant. And that's kind of cool, cool in the highest sense of the word. The sage doesn't speak of themselves as being among superiors, inferiors, or equals. Peaceful, rid of stinginess, they neither take nor reject. This is when you have given up the sense of self, you no longer think of yourself as superior, inferior, or equal. Why? Because you understand that comparison is impossible in the world. There is no comparison. We're always changing, we're always moving around, we're always something different. And when there is no sense of self, when there is no stability, when there is no essence in a person, when there is no real you, how can you compare yourself to anyone? All there is changeable qualities. So neither are you superior, nor are you inferior, but nor are you equal. And this is kind of a nice idea that we're not really equal either, because in much of modern society we have this idea that everyone is kind of equal. It comes from things like the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights. Yeah, we are kind of born, what is it, we're born equal in dignity and rights or something like that. It doesn't say why we are born equal in dignity and rights, it just says that as if it is an obvious thing. But actually from a Buddhist point of view, maybe not. Yeah, we're just born according to our karma. Are we born equal? I'm not sure about that. We're born quite different. You look around the world, we're all a bit different. So I'm not sure. But the point is that we cannot compare ourselves to others. We're always changing. It doesn't mean that we should feel superior or inferior. We shouldn't, of course. All we should know is that we are different streams, different currents of life, different currents of five khandhas, moving through the world, always morphing into something else. You can never know whether other people are better or worse than you. When you see someone who is in a difficult situation, someone who is mentally ill, someone who is sleeping rough outside, never look down upon that person and think that you are better, because you have been in that situation in the past. And unless you get out of this problem of samsara, you will be there again in the future. So when you see that mentally ill person, when you see that person being homeless, sleeping rough under a bridge, see yourself in that person. And there's something very beautiful about that. When you see yourself in other people, whoever they might be in this world, they are the opposite gender, people coming from a different culture, a different country, people who are rich or poor, intelligent and stupid, whatever it might be, handicapped, not handicapped. Whenever you see a person who you feel is different from you, remember to see yourself in that person. You have been there before. You will be there again in the future. And the moment you see yourself in another person, at that point you make a human connection to that person. The distance between you and that person disappears. Instead of othering that person, instead of making them something different, you understand we are actually basically the same. We have all been through these things all along. And then when you see someone in a difficult state, somewhere maybe you never want to be, instead of looking down upon that person or looking up to a person who is superior, whatever, instead you have compassion, because you understand when you have compassion for them, you also have compassion for yourself. If you other that person, you're also othering something within yourself that will come out again in the future. So this is the idea of being able to have compassion for everyone in the world, never feeling superior. Sometimes people say that, when I do something kind to others, when I support someone in a difficult situation, or I give something to someone else, I feel superior because I am the one doing the good deed and they are the recipient. But that's the wrong way to think about things. Never think things in that way, because you have been the recipient in the past. You will be a recipient in the future. And anyway, there's nothing wrong with being a recipient. We should all be recipients from time to time. Sometimes people say, I prefer to give. I don't really want to receive in the world, but I prefer to give. There's something wrong with that. There is a conceit in that. There's a sense that somehow you are superior when you give, but you don't receive. We should all be receivers. It's beautiful to receive. Because when you receive from someone else, what you're doing, you're allowing someone else to do good karma. So never be afraid of receiving from others. Their kindness, their support, whatever it might be. It's a good thing. Just say thank you or whatever you want to say. It doesn't matter. It doesn't make you inferior. And so we all need to be in both positions in this life, both givers and receivers. That is when our life is in balance. And we should never make that allow ourselves to somehow feel that we are superior or inferior in any way. That is the right way to think about these things. So this is the idea. And of course, the more highly evolved you are on the Buddhist path, the more less you feel the sense of superiority, equality, and inferiority, the more you just, even though you actually are called the superior person, when you become an Arya, you're actually called superior in the suttas, you're the Sapurisa, the good person. Actually, you don't feel that way, even though you, from the sutta point of view, you are superior. Peaceful, rid of stinginess, you neither take nor reject. You have given up everything, and because you have given up everything, there's nothing more to reject, there's nothing to take, and you just go flow through the world in a peaceful and beautiful way. That is the idea of the sage, feeling happiness and joy within, the highest kind of happiness. And you look upon humanity and you have compassion for all these humans still trapped in craving, trapped in the suffering of the world. You are free of all that. You are above it all. And you maybe then, because you have that compassion, you start teaching in the world like the Buddha himself did. Okay, so there you are. That is the Atta Danda Sutta, the taking up of punishment and sticks and violence and all of these kinds of things. It's a beautiful little sutta, and but the main point I'm trying to kind of bring out here is just the idea of the world being unsatisfactory, and we need to do something with our lives to move in a different direction. So that is all very kind of serious and interesting, perhaps. Now I'm going to have a look at another sutta, which is actually quite different. And sometimes I wonder why on earth did I include this sutta? Because I kind of put this together a while ago for some other retreat somewhere, and I think, I'm not sure about this particular sutta. But anyway, we're just going to, because it's there, we're going to have a look at it. It's like, what did it say? There's a famous mountaineer, Mallory or whatever, New Zealand, back in the 1950s, he climbed Mount Everest. And he was asked, why did you climb Mount Everest? And his answer was, because it is there. That was his answer. And so I'm going to do the sutta because it's there. It's the same kind of theory. So, anyway. Oi, okay, I'm just going to... All right. So this particular sutta is about called the Great Dreams. And these are the dreams of the Bodhisattva, the dreams of the Buddha-to-be before his awakening. And they kind of presage his awakening. I think one of the reasons why I brought this sutta out is precisely because we're looking at the Buddha-to-be, right? We're looking at the Buddha before his awakening, and this is one of the things that happened before his awakening. He had these dreams. So this is one reason, simply because it is about the Buddha before his awakening. But the other reason is that it is interesting that this is actually in the suttas. Why is it there? Why does the Buddha talk about his dreams in the suttas? In the modern world, we tend to underestimate dreams. We don't take dreams very seriously. There are some exceptions to that. There are some kind of psychiatrists and psychoanalysts, and especially apparently the Jungian psychoanalysts, they take dreams very seriously. Because this is one of the things that Jung did. But generally speaking, in the modern world, we're not really interested in dreams. But the Buddha must have been interested in dreams, otherwise he wouldn't talk about it. So there's kind of a different worldview. And this kind of, I find this fascinating, why the Buddha talks about dreams. It must mean that this is important somehow. And this shows us that when we enter the world of the Buddha, he actually looked at things in a slightly different way. And that's why we have to be very careful to think that we fully understand what the Buddha is saying. Dreams may actually be important. How can that be? How can dreams be important? And the reason is because the world of early Buddhism and the world very often in the history is much more mental than our world. The mind is very important. The mind is kind of the critical factor of that world. in the present kind of the way we look at the world now, it is physical, material phenomena that I consider important. And the mind is kind of some kind of secondary thing that doesn't mean anything. And I think that is part of the craziness of the modern world, if I'm going to be absolutely honest. But in those days, it is the mind that is first and foremost. And of course the mind is foremost. How do we know the world anyway? We know it through the mind. And once the mind is made the first and foremost thing in existence, it opens up new ways of thinking about the world. And one of those ways is to maybe take dreams themselves more seriously. So these are like prophetic dreams, dreams about the future, the Buddha seeing what is going to happen. This is an area of study even now, that people who look at the powers of the mind, that look at the prophetic ability of the mind to see the future. And that seems to be a reality, and it's kind of a fascinating reality. And the Buddha seems to confirm that that can happen in this particular sutta. So let's just have a very quick look at this. It's not super duper important, but it's kind of interesting here. So mendicants, before his awakening, five great dreams appeared to the realized one, the perfected one, the fully awakened Buddha, when he was still not awake but intent on awakening. What five? This great earth was his bed. Himalaya, the king of mountains, was his pillow. His left hand was laid down in the eastern sea. His right hand was laid down in the western sea. And both his feet were laid down in the southern sea. This is the first great dream that appeared to the realized one before his awakening. Next, a kind of grass called the crosser grew up from his navel and stood pressing against the cloudy sky. This is the second great dream that appeared to the realized one before his awakening. Next, white caterpillars with black heads crawled up from his feet and covered his knees. This is the third great dream that appeared to the realized one before his awakening. Next, four birds of different colors came from the four quarters. They fell at his feet, turning pure white. This is the fourth great dream that appeared to the realized one before his awakening. Next, he walked back and forth on top of a huge mountain of filth while remaining unsoiled. This is the fifth great dream that appeared to the realized one before his awakening. So these are the dreams, right? And it is probably not obvious to you what these things mean. They may not be very clear. But of course, dreams are very often, they are in symbolic language. It's a different kind of language than what we normally use. And so we kind of need to draw out a bit of the symbolism. And the Buddha actually helps us to do that anyway. So let's have a brief look at what these things symbolize. Now, as to when before his awakening, the realized one, the perfected one, the fully awakened Buddha was still not awake, but intent on awakening, this earth was his bed. Himalaya, the king of mountains, was his pillow. His left hand was laid down in the eastern sea, the right hand in the western sea, and both his feet were laid down in the southern sea. This was fulfilled when the Buddha awakened to the perfect awakening. So this is a symbol of his awakening, this idea. Of course, the idea of awakening is like an understanding of the world, understanding of the mind, understanding of what the world is like. And for that reason, it's as if his body is covering the whole earth. The head, I don't know if you can imagine India, if you imagine India, if the head is in the Himalayas and the hands in the ocean on both sides and the feet down to the south of India, roughly where Sri Lanka is found, he covers the whole Indian continent. And of course, in those days, the Indian continent, that was basically the known world. They didn't know about anything beyond that. Maybe they heard some rumors about some things, but that was essentially what they knew about. And so when the Buddha has this dream, it's like he is covering the whole world, like he has understood the whole world. He has grasped what the whole world is about. The world has kind of become his pillow, his mattress, etc., etc. And he's resting his head on the Himalaya mountains. The Himalaya mountains, of course, then as now, they are the greatest mountains in the world. And because they are the greatest mountain in the world, they were sometimes considered like the axis of the world. The axis is like the thing around which something turns. So the world turns around the Himalaya mountain. This is the core, the essence of the world, if you like. The thing around which the world spins. And now he uses that axis as his pillow. It's again this idea of having overcome something, being greater than something. Yeah, it's kind of the idea behind this. So the awakening experience, yeah, the going beyond the world, covering the world, having understood what this is all about, is kind of what this dream is seems to be suggesting here. I don't know, maybe, are there any Jungian psychoanalysts here? Maybe they can tell us a bit about these dreams and we can kind of figure out what's going on. No Jungian psychoanalysts? Okay. Oops. That's a shame. Anyway, we will invite some Jungian psychologists on the next retreat and we'll do the great dreams and we'll see what happens. All right, next one. As to when the kind of grass called the crosser is like crossing over, right, grew from his navel and stood pressing against the cloudy sky. That was fulfilled after the Buddha had awakened to the Noble Eightfold Path. It was well proclaimed wherever there are gods and humans. So the navel, and the kind of the path going into the sky, kind of disappearing into the sky, into the unknown. It says cloudy here, probably because then it kind of disappears into the unknown. And this idea of following a path, starting with the navel. The navel, again, is like the kind of the center of the body, in a sense. Emerging from the center of things and then going towards the unknown awakening. The grass going out of the navel, the Noble Eightfold Path. Not entirely sure exactly how the symbolism is to be understood, but something like that I think is good enough. We don't have to know all the details. As to when white caterpillars with black heads crawled up from its feet and covered his knees. This was fulfilled when many white-clothed lay people went to refuge for him for life. So you have the caterpillars with black heads, and someone did some research on this, and apparently there are such caterpillars. In India, they have white bodies and black heads, and they are very cute. If you look at them check them out on the internet, white caterpillars with black heads, they are cute, just like the lay people are cute. Right? The cute lay people, the lay people who kind of practice well and they smile and they're really happy, they're kind of cute, from a monk's point of view. Anyway, I'm being a bit silly, so just please forgive me. So you're crawling up from the feet and you're covering the knees. This symbolizes the idea the feet are like the lowest part of the body. This is why we never point our feet towards the Buddha statue. You know that when someone comes to Dhammaloka Center and they lie down and they point their feet directly towards the Buddha statue, you know they have never been to Buddha Center before. Straight away, they are completely clueless about what is going on. It is considered impolite in good Buddhist circles to do that. And this is for this reason, that feet are like the dirty part of the body, which kind of makes sense when you think about it. And the Brahmins in those days, they would say that they had this idea that the Brahmin caste, they are born from the mouth of Brahma. Brahma is the highest god in the Hindu kind of idea of gods. The Brahmins are born from his mouth, like the word, the Om or whatever it is, emerges from the mouth. The next caste, the Kshatriyas, the kind of aristocrats, they are born from the chest of Brahma. And the next caste, the Vaishyas or whatever, the kind of merchant caste, they're born from the thighs, they are the strong ones, they're the ones who do all the work. And the Suddhas are born from the calves, I think, and then the final, maybe they're born, and then there's some outcasts, and they are born from the sole of Brahma's feet. And that includes all the samanas. That includes all the Buddhist monks and nuns. According to Brahmins, we are born from the sole of Brahma's feet. That's kind of how they used to look upon Buddhist monastics. Yeah, we were really dodgy according to the Brahmins. We were the lowest of the low, the dirtiest of the dirty. Yeah? That was the kind of the Buddhist monks and nuns. That's the way it was in those days. So the idea here is that when you crawl up from the feet, yeah, of the Buddha to the knees, you're kind of elevating yourself. You're emerging from the dirt. You're getting brainwashed. Yeah, giving a good clean of your mind, and then getting all those defilements out. And why they stop at the knees, I am not sure. Not sure what the knees have got to do with it. But at least you are emerging from the kind of dirty parts of the body and ending up at the knees. Yeah, that's all the lay people. The lay Buddhists. And then you have the next one, the four kinds. I'm going a little bit late, and I'll just finish this off very quickly. The four birds of different colors, they fell at his feet, turning pure white. This was fulfilled when the members of the four castes, aristocrats, Brahmins, merchants, and workers, went forth from the lay life to homelessness in the teaching and training proclaimed by the realized one and realized supreme freedom. Yeah, this is the idea of the four different castes going forth, four different colors, and they all become white. And of course, white symbolizes purity in Buddhism. And that's why the lay people are white, and here also the monastics, yeah, the birds turn white. And of course, the interesting thing here is that they all become the same color. Previously, they had different colors. Previously, they were divided according to social conventions of the time, the caste conventions. But once you ordain, those caste conventions are set aside. And it is the purity of the person that matters, the qualities of your heart. So everyone becomes white. And this is what happens when you go forth and you practice these teachings properly. And the last one, as to when he walked back and forth on top of a huge mountain of filth while remaining unsoiled. This was fulfilled when the realized one received robes, alms, food, lodgings, and medicines and supplies for the sick. And he used them untied, uninfatuated, unattached, seeing the drawbacks and understanding the escape. So the huge mountain of filth, these are the four requisites. It's kind of strange, isn't it? They're called filth here in this case. They are filth if you use them in the wrong way. This is kind of the point here. If you use these things in a way whereby you get tied and infatuated and all of these kind of things, and these things become important to you, then they are a problem. So you see them as potentially problematic, and you don't get attached to these things. You accept any kind of robe, any kind of alms food, any kind of thing that gets given to you, and you're satisfied with that. You're not too concerned about it. And otherwise, you're actually detracting, you are taking away from that beautiful path you're supposed to practice by just giving up something and then attaching to something else instead. So there you are, just a very brief going through of the five great dreams. And that is all for now, so please keep on enjoying yourself. And there will be some interviews now at 4 o'clock for those of you who have signed up. And then we'll see you back again at 7 o'clock this evening.